So let's start with a short meditation. So find a nice comfortable posture. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and simply allow your awareness to descend into your body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. Letting go of all of these things and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. bring your attention to the area of the abdomen. And simply focus on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And to help balance the mind, to help overcome agitation or distraction. On each out-breath, simply relax, release any distractions, and very gently return to focusing on the breath in the area of the abdomen. And to help overcome dullness or being spaced out, then on each in-breath, you can arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. And so on each out-breath, relaxing and releasing. And on each in-breath, arousing and refreshing the focus. If you find that you're constantly becoming distracted, then you might like to experiment with counting the breath as a way to stabilize the mind. To do this, at the end of the in-breath, mentally note one, and then focus on the sensations of the breath on the following out-breath, following in-breath, and then mentally note two. So then we can mentally count the breaths, one up to 10, and start back at one. And if you lose count at any point, simply go back to one. So experiment with counting the breaths and see if it helps to stabilize the mind. And then we can set our motivation for the day. So try to generate the best possible motivation for our time together here today. So yesterday we had a little bit of an overview, and particularly we looked at a little bit of an overview of the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching that the Buddha gave after he achieved enlightenment and the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And then also yesterday afternoon we looked a little bit at the mind, the Buddhist concept of mind. And so today we're going to begin to look at the Lam Rim. So remember, Lam Rim is a Tibetan word. Lam means path, Rim means stages. So Lam Rim is the stages of the path to enlightenment. And it's a structure of practice that was brought into Tibet from by the great Indian master Lama Atisha in the 11th century. And he wrote his classic text, Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, where he laid out the practices that we need to engage in this very step-by-step manner, and hence the word Lam Rim, stages of the path. And then this was later expanded upon by great Tibetan master Lama Tsongkhapa in the 14th, 15th century. And he wrote a number of Lam Rim texts. And as a result of his efforts, we have actually the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed. And so the Lam Rim structure is the normal structure that we use within the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. Remember, the original school of Tibetan Buddhism that was formed was the Nyingma school around the 8th century through Padmasambhava. And there, the highest level of practice that is often taught is this Dzogchen, or the great perfection. And this is very much a nature of the mind approach. But also in the Nyingma school, we have a presentation of what's called the nine jhanas or vehicles, which is also a very much step-by-step approach to the path to enlightenment. The highest level of that is Dzogchen. And then also we have the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism, being formed also around the 11th century. The main system of practice there is Mahamudra. But also in the Kagyu school, they have very much a structured approach, because the Kagyu school was formed through Gampopa, who synthesized these oral Mahamudra instructions with the Lam Rim instructions from Lama Atisha. So also in the Kagyu school, the highest level of practice is Mahamudra, very similar to Dzogchen, but also there is a sort of a structured approach there. And then also we have the Sakya school forming around the same time, and their system of practice is called Lamdre, paths and results. And so also there we have this very much structured approach. So in all of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, we have a very clear presentation of the path to enlightenment. And so we're going to be following here the Gluck presentation, the Lam Rim structure, the stages of the path to enlightenment. And we very briefly looked at the sort of the structure yesterday afternoon. So if we can return to our two-page summary of the Lam Rim structure, we can see that the very first topic here is relying on a teacher. And then following that, it talks about the stages of how the student's trained, having relied on the teacher. And the very first topic is an exhortation to take full advantage of a life of leisure and opportunity, which is for us to reflect on the fact that we have this precious human life and we have a great opportunity to make this human life meaningful. And then, of course, the question is how to make this human life meaningful. And so here in the Lam Rim structure, we can see that we can make our human life meaningful at three stages or three levels. And so we can see that here, and it talks about this person of small capacity, down the bottom, the person of medium capacity, and over the back, the person of great capacity. And so what do we mean by these three levels of small, medium, and great capacity? So again, let's return here to our outlines. We were looking at very briefly yesterday on page 6, about halfway down or a little bit towards the bottom. About how to take full advantage of this life of leisure and opportunity. And under there, there's an outline how all scriptures are included within the paths of the three types of persons. So let's go over that again. So we were looking at that yesterday, and it says here that all the teachings given by the Buddha simply accomplish the welfare of living beings. And this welfare is twofold. This provisional goal of high status of human or deity. So high status simply means to have a good life, a good condition within this cycle of samsara. As we're going to shortly see this morning, that there are a number of different types of existences that are possible. Some are better than others. And so high status refers to those types of existences that give us good conditions to be able to follow the spiritual path. So that's the minimum that what we can do to make our life meaningful is to continue to ensure that we have these good conditions in the future. And then it talked about here, it said that high status and the goal of certain goodness, or often translated as definite goodness. And it says here, of liberation or omniscience. So liberation is talking about nirvana. Omniscience is talking about the goal of enlightenment. So we can strive for also personal liberation from this wheel of samsara, or we can strive for the further goal of enlightenment. So there are these sort of three levels of making our life meaningful, which correspond to the person of small capacity, medium capacity, and great capacity. Just to clarify a few points in that paragraph further, it says, many of the Buddha's statements pertain to the attainment of the temporary goal of high status. All these statements included in the teaching of person of small capacity. So this is what we've already mentioned. And then it says, many of the Buddha's statements pertain to the vehicle of the Pratika Buddha and Shravaka. Shravaka and Pratika Buddha are two approaches to practice. Shravaka really means the hearer, someone who listens to a lot of instructions from the teacher and follows the teacher very closely. Whereas Pratika Buddha here is often translated as solitary realizer, someone who really more goes off on their own
to practice the path. They get some instructions, but then they go off on their own to practice the path. So these are two styles of practice. One that's hearing instructions all the time. The other one who sort of then goes off and into solitude. Both of those types of practitioner are striving for the goal of nirvana. So both of those are within this medium capacity, which it says in the next sentence. All of these statements are included in the teachings of the person of actual medium capacity. And then it says the Mahayana of the perfections and the Mahayana of mantra are included in the teachings of person of great capacity. So here, when we say the Mahayana of perfections, then we're talking about the six perfections, the practices that we need to engage in to strive for the goal of enlightenment. And then when it talks about the Mahayana of mantra, mantra here is another word for tantra or Vajrayana. So within the Mahayana, we have these two levels of practice. And so in those two levels of practice, they're sometimes referred to as sutra and tantra. So within here, a person of great capacity, then that person can strive at two levels. At the sutra level, which is the normal six perfections practices, and at the higher level of tantra or Vajrayana practice. So, therefore, someone of small capacity is simply striving for a good future life within samsara. Someone of medium capacity is striving for the goal of nirvana. So, of course, the instructions here of a person of medium capacity are the same instructions as we find within the Theravada tradition, because in the Theravada traditions we are striving for the goal of nirvana. Whereas someone of great capacity who's striving for enlightenment, of course, this is within what's called the Mahayana vehicle. And so then we are going to look at the various instructions at each of those levels in the Lam Rim over the coming days. And so this, I think, related to a question yesterday, is this Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, are they sort of different or are they just sort of levels? And so we can see from here it's really levels of practice, that the very foundation level, even below the Theravada, is the foundation of just striving for a good future. And then on that basis, we have then the Theravada level of practice where we are striving for the goal of nirvana. And on that basis, we have then the Mahayana level of practice striving for the goal of enlightenment. And the highest level of that Mahayana is the Vajrayana or Tantra level of practice. So these are sort of levels of practice. So we're going to have a look through the Lam Rim at the various levels of practice and see how each one builds on the previous level. So that's a very brief overview of how the Lam Rim is structured in terms of these three types of person. Any questions about that before we go into the text? Yeah.
Would it be appropriate to think of this kind of like a journey you take where the first place you stop is the small town and then you proceed on to the medium town? But you wouldn't jump from the small to the great town because you have to go on this journey.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. But what we can see is that to get to the goal of enlightenment, we need to pass through these goals. But we can have even, and we have to take those steps. So the first step is we have to take the steps to ensure this. Then we have to start taking the steps to ensure this and this. But even from the very beginning, we can have the bigger vision that, you know, this is really the ultimate goal I'm striving to. But to get there, I have to go through these steps because these are the basis. Without this, you won't get here. Okay, so let's now go into the Lamrim. So as we see here on this brief outlines, the very first topic here is how to rely on a teacher. So let's have a look at that now in our Lamrim here. Of course, we have a number of pages of outlines before that, and the first, back on page one, is showing the greatness of the teaching's author in order to establish this of noble origin. So there it talks a lot about the history of Lama Atisha and how the Lamrim instructions came to Tibet through Lama Atisha. And then we see on page two of the outlines how to listen to and explain the teachings. And actually there, down at the bottom of page two, we have this abandoning the faults, three faults of the vessel, which I briefly talked about on the first evening. And then down towards the bottom of page three, it says how to lead students with the actual instructions. And the very first topic here in the Lamrim then is how to rely on the teacher, the root of the path. So then, of course, we can ask a question then, does this mean then to even begin anything we have to find a teacher? Because here we have relying on a teacher, the root of the path. So it seems to suggest here that that's the very first thing we need to do, is to find a teacher. Remember that this Lamrim structure was introduced into Tibet in the 11th century. And so, of course, at that time, most people were illiterate. And even if, like I said, even if there was any text available, they probably couldn't read it. And so the only way someone could even begin to do anything would be to find a teacher and get instructions. Without that, you couldn't begin to do anything. So, of course, things are a little bit different in our modern society. You know, we have lots of texts and books. We have a lot of audio and things on the internet. We have a lot of stuff available that we can begin to do something without the need of a personal teacher. So I think now, of course, we can begin to do things without having a personal teacher. But having said that, there are a lot of advantages to having a personal teacher. Because all of these texts and approaches to practice provide very beneficial, useful practices to engage in. But which ones are most effective for us, you know? Because there's a whole range of practices, but, you know, we haven't got unlimited time, so we want to be as effective as possible. We don't want to be engaging in practices that are not really bringing us a lot of benefit and not doing practices that would give us a lot of benefit. So, therefore, a personal teacher can tailor the practices to our specific needs, because they will, if they're qualified, they'll know us better than we know ourselves. And so they will be able to tailor the practices to make them most effective for us. But also, of course, with a personal teacher, sometimes we find in our practice, we find some obstacles and we don't know how to overcome these obstacles. Sometimes they're external, sometimes internal. So a teacher can help us to overcome obstacles in our practice. And often they can even help us to see these difficult situations not really as obstacles, but rather as fuel for our practice so we can actually benefit from them. For us now, often we don't see that. We just see a big problem. We don't know how to solve it. And then, of course, we do a practice, but sometimes we're not sure if we're doing it right. And maybe we're not doing it right, but we don't know. Whereas if we have a personal teacher, they can see if we're doing a practice correctly or not. So they can correct any mistakes in our approach to practice. And also, of course, historically, there was this feedback loop. So what would happen? The teacher would give the disciples some instructions. They would go off and try to implement that. A little bit later, they'd come back and they'd say how they're going. And then based on their feedback, then the teacher would adjust the instructions. Of course, without a personal teacher, we don't really have that feedback
happening. So there are many advantages to having a personal teacher. Of course, if we have unlimited time, then maybe you could make a case for not really having to need a teacher these days. But I think the reality is we don't have unlimited time. Our time is very precious and limited, so we want to make our spiritual practice as effective as possible. So I think a personal teacher can help us to ensure that. But how to, what sort of person should be the teacher? What should we look for in a teacher? And so that is here, one of the first outlines we see at the bottom of page 3, the defining characteristics of the teacher to be relied upon. And here it says, rely on a Mahayana teacher who is, and then it gives a list of 10 qualities here. So we can say, we can talk here that, you know, we've got different levels of practice here. We got the very high status level, we've got the Theravada level, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana level. So actually we can talk about the teacher at each of those levels. In the Theravada level of practice, the teacher is often called a Thera. Thera means elder, someone who's elder, more wise, more advanced in the spiritual path. A little bit like the old idea of the tribal elder who would sort of teach the young people in the tribe. So we have the Thera. Here at the Mahayana level, the teacher is often referred to in Sanskrit as a Kalyana Mitra. And Kalyana Mitra is often translated into English as virtuous spiritual friend. In Tibetan, Kalyana Mitra is Geshe. Ge is short for Gewa, which means virtue. She is short for Shenyin, meaning friend or spiritual friend. So Geshe is virtuous spiritual friend. But what we need to remember is that these days, this word Geshe is simply an academic title. It's when a monk, and now nun, studies many years, typically 20 years of study, and passes some formal academic exams, they're given the title Geshe. So these days, Geshe is simply an academic title. Historically, in the early days of Tibetan Buddhism, when you see early Tibetan masters called Geshe this, Geshe that, it wasn't an academic title. It was a title given to someone who was a qualified teacher of Mahayana. So we need to be careful with this. Just because someone's called Geshe this, Geshe that, nowadays, does not necessarily mean they're a qualified teacher of Mahayana. What it does mean is that they have done some study, they've passed some academic exams, so they have some reasonable knowledge, intellectual knowledge. But whether or not they're a qualified teacher of Mahayana, we need to check out. And then we have at the level of Vajrayana or Tantra practice, the teacher is often referred to as the guru. Guru literally means someone heavy with qualities, someone who has a lot of qualities. And the word guru translated into Tibetan is lama. But again, I think these days this word lama is sometimes very loosely used, and often it's simply used as a sign of respect for an elder monk. So again, just because someone's called lama this, lama that, we shouldn't automatically assume they're a qualified teacher of Tantra or Vajrayana. We need to check them out. So how to check out the teacher is what's mentioned here in the text. In the text, it talks about 10 qualities we are to look for in a teacher of Mahayana, a Kalyana Mitra.
So let's have a look at those 10 qualities that we are to look for in the teacher. And they're listed in your outline there towards the bottom. The first three is disciplined, serene, and thoroughly pacified. And they respectively refer to ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So remember that the basis of the Mahayana is the Theravada level of practice. And the Theravada level of practice is based on the Four Noble Truths. And the practices there, remember, were the Eightfold Path or, condensed, the three higher trainings. Meaning that someone who's a qualified teacher of Mahayana needs to have the foundation. So the teacher needs to be well practiced in ethics, concentration, and wisdom. That's the foundation. So that's the first three here, which is disciplined is ethics, serene, concentration, and thoroughly pacified is this wisdom. Then we have the fourth quality mentioned here, good qualities surpassing those of student. So, of course, if they don't have more qualities than the student, then they're not going to be a very qualified teacher. And then we can, I want to list the 10 in a slightly different order because I want to group them together. So number 5 is actually number 6 here, has a wealth of scriptural knowledge. So remember in the Mahayana, it's a very vast path, many different practices. So if the teacher is only skilled in a certain subset of that and our needs fall outside of that, then they're not helpful. They're not going to be able to help us. So they need to have a wide range of scriptural knowledge to be able to help us. And remember that to achieve both nirvana or to achieve nirvana or to achieve enlightenment, we need to overcome ignorance. So we need to realize the nature of reality. We need to realize this thing I briefly mentioned the other day, emptiness. So therefore, if a teacher is going to help us to do that, they themselves need to have realized emptiness, which here is actually point 8, has a thorough knowledge of reality. So when it says thorough knowledge of reality, it, in the best case, of course, is experiential, to actually have realized the nature of reality, realized emptiness. So these 6 qualities are qualities within the teacher himself or herself. Within the teacher. Whereas the last 4 qualities are to do with qualities that are needed by the teacher to help to look after others. And so number 7 is here. It's listed as number 5, energetic. Energetic here means that the teacher puts a lot of energy into helping others, meaning, i.e., not lazy. Because even if the teacher has all these qualities, but they're very lazy when it comes to helping others, they're not much use to us. So number 7 here is that the teacher needs to be diligent in helping others. But not only does the teacher need to be diligent or putting effort into helping others, they need to be able to communicate well with us, because if they're not using language that we can relate to, they're no help to us. So this here is listed as number 9, skill in instructing disciples. So the teacher needs to be skilled in teaching. But not only does the teacher need to be skilled in communication to be able to teach, they need to have a good motivation. Because if their motivation is that so they become famous or they can maybe get a lot of offerings or money from students, they're not a qualified teacher. So they need to have here in number 7, possesses loving concern for the student. Or in other words, great compassion for the student. But of course, sometimes we're a little bit slow to pick up the instructions. And so then, of course, if we don't easily understand their instructions, they may just give up on us. So, of course, if they do that, they're not any help to us. So they also need to have great patience with us, which is the last quality here. Number 10, abandoned dispiritedness, meaning that if we're not easily understanding, that they don't just give up on us, but they have great patience with us. So these 4 qualities are the qualities they need for looking after others. So these are the 10 qualities that we need to look for in a qualified teacher of Mahayana. Any questions about any of these 10 qualities?
How are we supposed to determine, for instance, whether the teacher is thoroughly pacified or has attained shamatha?
Yeah. So in the texts, it says that it's important to thoroughly check out the teacher. And in some of these old texts, it actually says, you know, that may take up to 12 years. Of course, we can imagine in ancient India or ancient Tibet, it could take a long time, because maybe we're in a village, the teacher comes once a year or twice a year to the village, and then we never see them again. And so if they come for a couple of days, how are we going to check them out thoroughly? You know, and then once they're gone, there's no way of checking them out. Whereas, of course, in the modern day, it's much easier to check out. You know, there's a lot of communication and we can find out more about the teacher more easily. So probably in our modern days, we can do that more quickly. But how can we check out some of these qualities? Of course, we can, if we spend some time around the teacher, we can observe their behavior and their attitude and whether they're, you know, if they're being really patient with difficult people. You know, often in the teaching, if there's someone difficult, what is their attitude there? Are they really trying to help them or are they just sort of dismissing them? You know, so things like this. And then, of course, if people ask difficult questions, you know, are they answering these questions in a very good way? So certain qualities we can observe through the way they speak and so forth. And then, of course, you know, from their behavior, are they being ethical? And generally also in concentration, are they a very calm, focused person, or are they sort of quite agitated? So a lot of these things we can sort of see from their behavior and the way they speak. But, for example, this one here, realized emptiness, may be difficult. But again, if they're giving a teaching on emptiness, then does it sort of make sense based on our own understanding and so forth? And so what we can do, of course, is If there is someone else who's highly respected within that tradition, we can ask them what their opinion of this person is. So we can also, in that way, come to have some confidence that this person has these sorts of qualities. So there are a number of ways we can do that.
Does a geshe, since now it's more an academic term, need to be ordained or take a monk or nun vows?
Well, to get the academic title of geshe, yes, you have to be a monk or a nun, because the only place where you can do those studies to do those exams is in a monastery or nunnery.
Got it.
So this is a pretty special person you described. And most of us live in the United States. I think there's someone here from Canada. I don't feel like there's a bunch of these people running around. So are we consigned to sort of waiting for the guru to visit once a year in our village?
No. I mean, of course, this is the ideal list, yeah. But actually, in the text, if we go into the text, it says, these five qualities, loving, concern, knowledge of reality, and the three trainings are foremost. So the five most important of the ten are the three foundations, and then, of course, having realized some reality, and then having the great compassion. So these five are the core things that we are to look for in a teacher. But even that may be difficult to find. And so not here in the Lam Rim, but often then, in some of the texts that describe this, they say, okay, rock bottom minimum.
3 qualities. And none of these 10. The 3 qualities are that the first is that the teacher should have more qualities than faults. The second is they should be thinking more of future lives than this life. What does that mean? What that really means is this person caught up in the 8 worldly concerns? Are they worried about making lots of money, being famous, having a lot of praise and a good reputation? If they are, they're not a qualified teacher. So that's what it means to think more of future lives than this life. Are they caught up in the 8 worldly concerns or not? And the third quality is that they should be thinking more of others than themselves. Meaning, what's their attitude? Are they really being a very selfish person? Are they really just thinking about themselves and not thinking about the students? So these are sort of the, sometimes mentioned as the sort of the rock bottom things that we really need to look for. But of course, as you mentioned, people with these sorts of qualities are not sort of, around the corner all the time. And then sometimes people hear this saying that says, when you're ready, the teacher will appear. You know, sounds all very romantic, you know. And so people have this idea that somehow they'll be lying on the couch at home, sipping their coffee, and then there'll be a knock on the door. They open the door, and then this person is in the door with a halo around their head saying, I'm here to help you. I think if this is our idea, we'd be waiting a long, long time. So what we can do is 2 things. One, of course, is to have an aspiration to meet a qualified teacher. And, you know, often we see in some of the practices this, even prayer, a prayer to meet qualified teachers. And then often people look at these prayers and they go, prayers, I don't want to do that. But actually, here, what we're saying is that a prayer is a sincere aspiration to meet a qualified teacher. And if we really, I mean, the power of the mind is immense. If we really have this sincere aspiration to meet qualified teachers, this plants very powerful imprints in our mind that sometimes by magic find us in a situation where we actually meet them. So we shouldn't dismiss this. I think this can be very powerful. So if we really want to meet a qualified teacher, I think we need to have that aspiration and really a deep aspiration to meet the qualified teacher. And then secondly, of course, we need to look for them and not just sit on our couch at home hoping that they'll knock on the door. So I think if we do these two things, I think we can meet a qualified teacher. And we shouldn't have too much preconceptions about what they look like. You know? Often people have this idea that it's certain, you know, that the teacher will be a certain way. And then, of course, they may meet people who are qualified, but because they're not the stereotype teacher they're looking for, they sort of dismiss them. And they're actually there in front of them, who's their actual qualified teacher. So, again, we shouldn't have this preconception about what this qualified teacher is going to look like. So I think if we can do this, then I think we can. And, of course, at a simple level, everyone and everything is a teacher. So even if we don't have this personal teacher, at least we can use everyone and everything as a teacher to help guide us in some way. At least that we can do. And we often even, you know, dismiss that. Because often we have this preconception and we fail to learn from other people, and we often then dismiss other people. And this is very unfortunate, you know, no matter what the situation. In fact, Lama Atisha is very famous for when he came to Tibet, he brought with himself an attendant who was a very obnoxious person. And then Tibetans saw this obnoxious person and said, "Why are you with him? Why don't you get some kind, helpful attendant?" And then Lama Atisha told the Tibetans, "This person is my most holy teacher." He picked him specifically for that reason, to test him. So, yeah. And we talked yesterday, you know, that he introduced this system of practice in Tibet called Lojong. And one of the strengths of Lojong is exactly this, is to see difficult situations and difficult people as our greatest teachers and to benefit from those situations. So I think if we can do that, it would be good.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Kind of historical. So did Atisha bring something that was being practiced in India to Tibet and then it was lost in India? So the Lam Rim, was this practiced in India and Atisha brought it to Tibet and then it was
So remember, Lam Rim is a way of packaging the practices. So of course, all the practices within the Mahayana were being practiced in India. But he introduced this system of practice, which I assume he found to be very helpful or beneficial for the Tibetans. He packaged all these practices in this specific way and called it this lamp for the path. So you'll find, of course, all these various practices. And that's what you'll find. If you look at even the other Tibetan traditions in the Kagyu and Nyingma, particularly at the foundation level, if you look at the actual practices, they're more or less the same, but they package them differently. They call them the package in a different way. Here, it's in the Lam Rim, it's packaged in terms of the three levels of person. In the Kagyu, it's packaged a different way. In the Nyingma, a little different way. But the core practices you'll find are the same. And so that's the packaging that Atisha put together for the Tibetans.
This is kind of small, but is it just what they consider like a good starting point is the difference in the schools, or why are they even separate as opposed to bringing them together?
Because everyone is different. Everyone has a different capacity, different disposition, different perspectives. And so Buddha taught according to people's capacities and perspectives. And then, of course, within certain cultures, there's different perspectives and attitudes and so forth. And so, therefore, to package these practices in such a way that are most effective for an individual and for different cultures and so forth. And so, therefore, it's wonderful that there are these different traditions available, because we as an individual can look at each one and see which package fits our character, fits the way of our perspective. And then we can use that effectively. Because if there was only one package and it didn't suit us, we'd be stuck. Fortunately, there are many packages. And so we can look and say, ah, that's the one that really I resonate with best. And we can dive into that.
Because I've spent time with Kona Kagyu too. So I'm kind of torn because, you know, they both seem good. And then it comes to the question of, gosh, I have to give up one to like to have. You know,
yeah, I mean, generally what I tend to recommend is, as a beginner, it's good to look around and find one that resonates. But then if we find a tradition that we resonate with, is to immerse ourselves in that. Because often what I sometimes find is people go, oh, I like a bit of this, a bit of this, bit of this, bit of this. Let's mix it all up and see what we get. And unfortunately, even though each of those individual practices may be useful, they're within a package, within a context. And some of these practices are based on certain perspectives. And so if you start mixing all these practices from many different traditions together, they actually may work against each other. And then we get a lot of confusion because they seem to be contradictory and they're not really working. And it's because they're not in a coherent package and they're not working together. So what I really recommend is to find a tradition that resonates with you and then immerse yourself in it. Then once you're well established in a particular tradition, then sometimes it can be helpful to look a little bit outside to broaden our perspective. But unless we're well established, if we keep looking around, we're just going to get confused. And because we're not going to understand how they fit together. So once we're well established though, my personal experience and many people I know, if we then look at some traditions close, like other Tibetan traditions maybe, then that can help broaden our perspective and actually supplement our practice a little bit. But if we just do that as a beginner, mixing and matching everything together, then it's going to be difficult. And then, of course, who do you go ask for advice? In which tradition? Because they're going to give you advice within their tradition. And if you're doing practices in other tradition, they're going to go, well, I don't know that. I mean, I can't help you with that. So, you know. Okay. But here in the text now, it says that we need to also be a qualified student if we want a qualified teacher. So that's down the bottom. And basically, to be a qualified student, three qualities. So here we see it is said that one who is non-partisan. So non-partisan means unbiased. So what does this mean, to be non-partisan or unbiased? It means to not put down or disparage any other valid spiritual tradition. So, for example, if we think that Buddhism is the best and other spiritual traditions like Christianity and Islam and Hinduism are inferior, then we're not a qualified student of Buddhism. We can ask the question here, which is the best spiritual tradition? There is an answer. Which is the best one? The one that works best for you. So maybe Buddhism is the best for you, but for someone else, maybe Christianity is the best, maybe Islam is the best, maybe Hinduism is the best. So we should understand that and not think that just because for me Buddhism seems to work the best, therefore everything else is inferior. If we do, we're not a qualified student of Buddhism. That's what unbiased means, is to not disparage or put down any other valid tradition. The second quality here, it says that we need to be intelligent. No, we do not need to have a PhD. Here we're talking about wisdom, but we're talking about a particular type of wisdom called discriminating wisdom. What that means is that we should not blindly accept anything we read or hear or advice from the teacher.
that we need to have discriminating wisdom to evaluate the instructions and to see whether they're beneficial or not, and if they are ethical or not. So if we are blindly following the advice of the teacher, we are not a qualified student. As with the quote I gave from the Buddha himself the other night, please do not merely accept what I tell you out of devotion to me. You need to be like a goldsmith who checks and tests the quality of the gold before accepting it. So this is what we mean by discriminating wisdom. To be a qualified student of Buddhism, we are not to blindly accept any advice. We are to evaluate it and only accept it if we believe it's beneficial and not unethical. The third quality here is diligent. We need to be diligent, not lazy. So we need to put effort, and we need to put effort at two things. What is we need to put effort into study and practice. I think when I came to Buddhism, I had maybe 1.5 out of 3. I definitely was not unbiased. I really thought Buddhism was the best. Everything else was worse, was inferior. I think I always had pretty good discriminating wisdom. I never really blindly accepted anything. I put some effort into study, and I put no effort into practice. Now I think I'm not too bad on respecting other traditions, and I'm starting to put a little bit of effort into practice. So if we want to be a qualified student of Buddhism, then if we don't have these qualities, we need to work on achieving these qualities. Any questions?
I mean, I just wonder with the unbiased, I mean, if say, you get involved with a discussion about religion with somebody, I mean, are you allowed to point out false and baloney in something if it comes up? Or can you just keep your mouth shut?
Again, it's, are we respecting, are we respecting that tradition or not?
Right.
You know? Of course, I think it's good to help other people, but if we're just poking faults at things, I mean, is that helping them? Is that our motivation? So we check the motivation. You know, are we really wanting to help the people, and are we really respecting that tradition or not? Maybe just because we don't agree with their perspective doesn't mean it's not helpful. Because even within Buddhism, I mean, technically you can poke holes in a lot of stuff in Buddhism, because we can talk about provisional teachings and definitive teachings. Provisional teachings are those teachings to help bring the person to the final goal, whereas technically you can maybe put fault in some of those teachings according to the highest view. But they're like steps on the ladder to that. So we need to understand that. That a lot of teachings within Buddhism and other traditions are skillful means of leading people.
But respectfully, you can still engage the discussion.
Sure.
Thanks for the advice.
Is the Lam Rim Path what's most widely taught in the U.S.?
Oh, in the U.S., this is my first visit here, so I got no idea.
I figured if you're trying to find a teacher, like, what's most widely taught might be...
Well, I know that this Vajrapani, of course, is part of the FPMT organization, and they're quite widely established in the U.S. In fact, their headquarters is in Portland, in Oregon, and they've got many centers in the U.S., so I know that. But as to other traditions, I don't know. I think many other traditions are also fairly widely spread in the U.S.
There's another tradition. There's a new Kadampa in Arlington, Texas. I think they've got like 30 or 40 in the United States. So they're lying around, and they're very much in the land realm as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does study include, or did it include for you, contemplation, analytical meditation?
Yeah, so study... of course, study and practice. I mean, study means to listen and to think about and contemplate, and practice means to internalize through meditation and integrating into daily life. So this sort of covers the whole spectrum, these two.
You said you were originally only interested in study, I guess.
Did yeah, so study is basically intellectual.
That didn't include analytical meditation?
No, not really. No. I mean, of course, there's a very much an overlap there between sitting down and contemplating something versus sitting in meditation and more or less going through the same contemplation. There's an overlap. But of course, the difference is that when we're sitting in meditation, then hopefully the mind is more quiet and still and focused. And so that contemplation can be much more effective and thereby help us to really internalize it. Whereas if we're sitting down just intellectually thinking about it, then often that intellectual thinking doesn't penetrate. I mean, we get a, maybe get a good intellectual understanding, but it doesn't seem to affect us at a personal level often. You know?
I also think that when you get into practice, at first you think of it as meditation, but then you think of it as how can I integrate this time off the cushion? But I think we gravitate to study because that's what we've known since we were little and we were sent off to school.
Yes, that's true. And both are important, you know. And sometimes, like myself early on, I just really gravitated to this because I'm a very intellectual person. But of course, if that's all you do in Buddhist path, then, I mean, gathering intellectual knowledge is not really going to transform your life. I mean, it may help a little bit, but not a lot. But then, of course, sometimes people, you know, some people don't like to study, you know, and they go, I just want to meditate. I mean, forget about the study. I just want to meditate. But then, of course, they sit down and they, what are they going to meditate on? They're just going to sit there and blank their mind or something? And then, of course, what happens is if someone does meditate without any study and they have some sort of experience, then how to interpret that? What does that experience mean? Is it valid? Not? Should I develop that or am I just spacing out? I mean, we got no framework. So often, there's a saying that says trying to meditate without study is like trying to climb a mountain without hands and feet. I mean, it doesn't work. It's very difficult. So we need both. But of course, each one of us is different. So how to balance? Where's the balance? And the balance will be different from person to person. That's where the qualified teacher can help us to strike the balance. They can know us very well. You know, some people like to have a more extensive framework for practice. Some people can practice effectively with a less framework. But for us, it's difficult to know. So we need that balance, but we need both.
But again, just to make sure I understand, practice is far more than sitting on the cushion. Practice is life.
Right? Yeah, practice actually comes up in the Lam Rim in the next session. And in fact, we can just very briefly jump to that now before we go for a break. So if you go, we're going to look at, it's coming up next. So, after this topic now, which we've more or less covered, down the bottom of page 4, it says a brief indication of how to sustain the meditation. And then under it says the actual way of sustaining meditation. There are two outlines. The first is what to do during the actual meditation session, and then halfway down page 5, what to do in between meditation sessions, which is basically the rest of the day. So to sustain meditation or sustain practice, there's two parts. There is what you do in meditation and what you do for the rest of the day. You know, because often you hear people say, you know, when do you do your practice? Oh, I do it every morning at 6:30 for half an hour or an hour. If this is our idea of practice, we're not going to get very far. Because if we diligently sit down every morning to meditate for half an hour or even an hour, but then we jump up and run around mindlessly as we normally do, then that little bit of benefit we'll get in the morning from meditation will get squashed by our mindless behavior for the rest of the day. We're not going to get anywhere. So if we want to effectively progress, we need both elements of practice, as we see in the next outline. Is that you need to internalize and then you need to integrate into daily life and you need to establish a daily life way that supports that, which is some of the elements that we're going to look at after the break.
Okay. Any last questions about relying on a teacher? Oh, there's one more point in the outline I wanted to mention. So then if we go over onto the top of page four, it says then how the student relies on the teacher. Just one or two points and then we'll go for a break. In the first paragraph, a little bit down, it says, therefore you should have few teachers, because this is discussion about, you know, is it okay to have one, more than one personal teacher? And the general advice is actually to have one personal teacher. Of course, we can go to a number of teachers to receive general instructions, but when it comes to personal advice, it's best to have one. And there's a reason for that. And that is that if we go to a teacher for personal instruction, then often the very thing that they're going to get us to do is the one thing we've been avoiding because it's the one thing we really need to work on. And so then we don't like what they say. We go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. So then person runs off to another teacher and probably gets the same advice, and they keep running off until they find a teacher who says something nice. This is not going to help us. And, of course, the other problem with that is if you go to more than one teacher for personal advice and you have two teachers that seem to give contradictory advice, what are you going to do? So, therefore, best to have one personal teacher. Because if you go to a teacher asking for personal advice, and then they may ask you if you have a personal teacher. If you say yes, I'll say do what they told you. Do what they told you. And then, of course, here, I'll jump down. If we go down halfway the page, it says how to rely on the teacher in practice. It says how can we rely on the teacher in terms of practice? Well, actually, let's just briefly, how to rely on thought first, further up. Basically, here, to develop faith and be respectful to the teacher. But then how to rely in practice, halfway down, it says there are three avenues. The first is to offer material gifts, so we can give material gifts. The second one is to serve the teacher through our body and speech, so to help the teacher verbally and physically if we can. And then the third avenue here is practicing in accordance with their words. So that's what's going to make the teacher most happy with us, if we implement their instructions. They're not going to be so happy about us giving them lots of gifts and so forth. They'll be more happy if we implement their instructions. But then the following line says, if the abbot or the teacher here instructs you to do what is not in accord with the teachings, refuse. Meaning, if they give us personal advice and we believe it to be unethical, we must not follow that advice. We must ask them why it's not unethical, and if they can't give a satisfactory answer, we must not follow their advice. That's part of being a qualified student. But of course, we should not refuse their advice just because it's something difficult to do. Because usually it's the one thing we really need to work on. Actually, just one little story about this. Actually, it's relating to Lama Yeshe, who's the founder of this organization and this center here. Many years ago, I think it was in Dharamsala, this is where I heard the story, is that he had a disciple there who wanted to impress. I don't know what his motivation was, but he went to see Lama Yeshe, you know, so one person at a time went in to see him. And this person went in, and this person gave Lama Yeshe a gold Rolex watch, like, you know, thousands of dollars worth. And then the next person that went in, Lama Yeshe gave it to this person. And so this person came out with the gold Rolex, and this first person got very upset, apparently. So this is really a sign of a qualified teacher that they're not interested in that. Also, another very short story. When I was studying many years ago in Italy, we hosted His Holiness Dalai Lama's been hosted at the center there a number of times. He came for a visit. We had a big teaching event. And in Tibetan tradition, it's often traditional at the end of a big event to openly declare the financial status of the event. So, you know, they say, these are the costs, blah, blah, blah. This is the bottom line, you know, if they made money or not. And in our event, the person who came up at the end said, blah, 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 we made a loss of a few thousand euros or something. And then His Holiness had received lots of offerings, and he basically gave all of his offerings to the centre to cover the loss. Because his offerings more or less came pretty close to that, and he said, here, you take that to cover your loss. So this is, I think, a sign of qualified teacher.
I read that a bad sign for teachers if they praise you a lot. And I had a teacher once who stopped, and they had praised me kind of. How do you feel about that?
I'm going to talk about this.
Sorry.
In general. This is one of the topics I'm going to talk about a few times in the Lamb Room, so we'll leave it till then. So let's take a break and come back at 10:45, and then we'll move on to the next topic, which is talking about how to sustain our practice.